Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, January 6th, 2021. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, $50 oil positive indicator, but uncertainty remains. Analysts, the higher price is a positive indicator, but don't expect any immediate reaction. By Mella McEwen. In 1996, then Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan coined the phrase irrational exuberance to discuss a soaring stock market amid the dot-com bubble. West Texas intermediates rise above $50 level after a brutal 2020 may be welcome news to Permian Basin oil and gas producers, but there is no display of irrational exuberance. For oil prices, it's been the virus versus vaccines in, and with the arrival of vaccines, WTI is starting to get out of the virus alley of $40 to $50. Daniel Juergen, author of The New Map, Energy, Climate, and the Clash of Nations, told the Reporter Telegram by email. The danger now is the new surge of the virus and the shuttering of economic activity again in many countries. But Saudi Arabia is delivering a strong message with its decision to cut its output in the face of the winter surge in COVID-19, and the oil market is responding. A day at $50 will not bring about an immediate surge in oil field activity, so don't expect to see a forest of drilling rigs around the Permian Basin overnight. As Matt Raglan, president of Wellworks, told the Reporter Telegram, the higher price is a positive indicator, but he doesn't expect any immediate reaction. He pointed out the oil field is a slow ship to turn, and increased activity won't happen overnight. But, he said, he expects a slow but positive recovery is underway. Steve Pruitt, President and Chief Executive Officer of Elevation Resources, LLC, told the Reporter Telegram by email he thinks prices have gotten ahead of the vaccines and reopening of global economies. Still, he does expect prices to move toward $60 a barrel in 2022. Like Pruitt, Chris Midgley, head of analytics at S&P Global Platts Analytics, sees prices at $50 more due to sentiment about the vaccines and resulting economic growth than market fundamentals. Indeed, he said he doesn't see fundamentals supporting prices much higher than $50 a barrel. Fundamentals on the oil side are bearish because of the huge amounts of stocks built up, he said, as he participated in a media event updating the company's 2021 outlook last month. Oil demand will recover $6 million barrels a day of its loss, he said, but will still be 2 million barrels below 2019 levels. Recovery in demand for jet fuel will be slow. While some believe oil production cuts and less capital spent on drilling will drive prices up, the market recognizes that for the long term, lower prices are okay to sustain production. He predicted prices will struggle in the first half of 2021 as continued economic shutdowns through next March and April to control the pandemic weigh on demand. There's a lot of supply headwind at $50 to $51, he observed. If you were happy to hedge at $43, you should definitely hedge now. Despite the caution, operators are more optimistic about oil prices for 2021. According to the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas's quarterly energy survey, respondents expected to see oil prices at $50 by the end of the year, up from almost $44 reported in the third quarter. Prices ranged from a low of $35 to a high of $70, with the majority forecasting prices between $50 and $55, followed by between $45 and $50. This article is entitled, 2,200 Midlanders Sign Up for COVID Vaccine Waitlist, by Caitlin Randall. More than 2,200 people reserved a slot on the Midland Health Department's COVID-19 vaccine waitlist after it was opened for individuals aged 65 and older or with chronic health conditions, according to a city spokeswoman. The health department received its first shipment of the Moderna vaccine on December 29th. By the next day, appointments for all 200 doses had already been booked. A city spokeswoman said 2,211 people had added their names to the health department's wait list as of Tuesday morning. Health department officials don't yet know when they'll receive another shipment, she said. Whitney Craig with the health department previously said in an interview that they expect the next shipment will also include 200 doses. Vaccine rollouts have moved slowly and been met with confusion throughout the state and nation. Governor Greg Abbott said on December 22nd that 1.4 million healthcare workers and at-risk Texans would be vaccinated by the end of 2020, but that didn't happen. Texas's Health and Human Services COVID-19 dashboard on Tuesday showed that just 439,000 Texans have received the vaccine, meaning more than half of the 1.3 million doses shipped to the state have yet to be administered. Midland Memorial Hospital received 1,950 doses of the Pfizer vaccine on December 17th and immediately began administering it to staff. Any remaining doses, because of workers who declined the vaccine, were given to other healthcare providers in the community, according to hospital officials. Just more than 1,000 Midland County residents, or 0.8% of the population, had received an initial dose of the vaccine as of Tuesday, according to the state's dashboard. No one in the county or state has yet received the second dose of the vaccine required for full immunization. The state has guaranteed a second dose of the vaccine will arrive within a few weeks of the first shipment for those who received initial doses, according to city and hospital officials. It would be at least 11 months before just those on the waiting list receive initial doses if the number of doses and frequency of shipments stays the same. In December, the Department of Health and Human Services reported that the Trump administration, through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and Department of Defense, will purchase an additional 100 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine from Pfizer. Texas DSHS stated in a memo that they're expecting a vaccine to be available to the general population by the spring of this year, but that could change depending on vaccine production and how quickly other vaccines become available. The form to join the health department's waitlist is available at midlandtexas.gov/forms.aspx?FFD=159. This article is entitled National Weather Service. 2020 in Midland is historical for its heat, lack of rain, by Stuart Doreen. For the seventh time since 2011, Midland has experienced one of the warmest years on record. The National Weather Service website reports 2020 was the fifth warmest year on record in Midland, about 2.6 degrees above normal. The NWS also shows that the five warmest years happened in the last 10 years. The average temperature in 2020, 66.5 degrees, according to the NWS, trails 2017, 67.5, 2016, 67.3, 2012, 67.0, and 2011, 66.7. Seven of the nine warmest have happened since 2011. Included in the historical heat notes for 2020 was that the summer, spring, and 2019-2020 winter were among the 10 warmest in Midland, and 2020 set a record for the most consecutive 90-degree days, 94 from June 3rd through September 4th. The NWS reported that 2020 was not only one of the five warmest in Midland's history, but it was also among the driest. Preliminary totals show the 7.86 inches of precipitation was nearly 7 inches less than normal for a year in Midland, 14.6 inches, but also made 2020 the 10th driest. The year 2020 started wet with 5.27 inches during the first 3 months and 2.59 inches the rest of the way. The dry conditions have the region experiencing extreme drought conditions, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. The U.S. seasonal drought outlook shows the drought is expected to persist in and around Midland. The Climate Prediction Center shows that 2021 will start out like Midlanders experienced for most of 2020. The 30-day forcast calls for a 40 to 50% chance of above-average temperatures and a 33% chance of below-average rainfall. The 90-day forecast, January through March, shows a 60% chance of above-average temperatures and below-average precipitation. The CPC is calling for above-average temperatures during the entire year. Toward the end of the year, the chance of rain is expected to be normal. This is the local and state page. This article is entitled, Midland Health, last week set a record for positive tests, by Stuart Doreen. New Midland Health numbers reported Tuesday showed a new record for people who tested positive for COVID-19 last week at Midland Health testing centers. Midland Health, on its website, reported Tuesday that 407 people tested positive for coronavirus. That was more than the 401 people who tested positive the week of November 21st. Midland Health also reported the number of tests recorded was 1,372, so the positivity rate moved to 29.7%. That trailed the July 4th week, 31.8%, as far as the highest positivity rate in 1 week. Midland Health also reported that 114 people have tested positive this week. The positivity rate this week, as of Tuesday morning, is 28.1%. Just as the number of people testing positive and the positivity percentages continued to spike, the city of Midland on Tuesday reported another 3 COVID-19-related deaths, which took place in December. Two happened December 29th, a female in her 50s and a female in her 70s. The other death took place on December 23rd, a man in his 60s. All three were being treated at Midland Memorial Hospital and had underlying health conditions. The three reported Tuesday brought the number of Midland County resident deaths during the pandemic to 190. The number of coronavirus cases continued its upward trend. On Tuesday, Midland Health Department officials reported 187 cases from Monday. That increased the number of cases to 287 this week, and the number of cases during the pandemic, confirmed and unconfirmed, to 13,813. Other notable numbers include the percentage of COVID patients of total rooms at Midland Memorial Hospital fell from 32% to 29%. 29% is the 7-day average. The percentage of COVID-19 rooms filled is 90%. 86% is the 7-day average. Of the 295 inpatient rooms, 247 rooms, or 84%, are filled. The 7-day average is 81%. This is the politics page. This article is entitled, Cornyn Won't Join Republicans Planning to Object to Certification of Biden's Win, by Patrick Svitek, Texas Tribune. U.S. Senator John Cornyn, Republican Texas, announced Tuesday that he isn't planning to object to the certification of the Electoral College vote in Congress, splitting with a growing number of GOP colleagues that most notably includes the state's junior senator, Ted Cruz. In a lengthy letter to Texans, Cornyn noted that he has supported President Donald Trump's right to challenge election results in the courts, but that Trump's lawsuits have gone nowhere, and recounts in multiple states have also failed to change the outcome. Trump has continued to push baseless claims of widespread fraud in the election, including at a campaign rally Monday night in Georgia. As a former judge, I view this process with the same impartial, evidence-based decision-making as I did my job on the bench, wrote Cornyn, a former justice on the Texas Supreme Court. So unless substantial new evidence is presented during the challenges to each state's ballots, I will not object to the certification of that state's election results based on unproven allegations. Cornyn's position is not much of a surprise based on comments he has made in recent weeks expressing skepticism about Trump's challenge chances of overturning his loss to President-elect Joe Biden. But the letter marks Cornyn's most extensive explanation of his position yet, and it comes as Texas's other senator digs in on his plan, along with 10 other GOP senators, to object to the Wednesday certification of Biden's win, unless they can secure an emergency audit of the November results. A source familiar with Cruz's plans, but who was unauthorized to speak on the record, said that Cruz intends to specifically object to the certification of electors from Arizona. The news was first reported Tuesday by the Washington Post. Cruz told conservative radio host Mark Levin on Monday that he did not want to set aside the election, but rather to press for the appointment of an electoral commission. In his letter, Cornyn made clear he was not a fan of Cruz's audit proposal, which Cruz has said can be done in the 10 days before the inauguration. Cornyn suggested he too supports a review of election issues, but something less hasty and more deliberate, such as an independent commission in the vein of the Commission on Federal Election Reform. That was a private, bipartisan panel that looked into problems with the 2000 and 2004 elections. As to timing and practicality of an emergency audit, I am much more dubious, Cornyn said. The design of the proposed commission to conduct such an audit will inevitably fail. Cruz and Cornyn are in very different positions politically. Cornyn is coming off a re-election victory in November that secured him another six-year term to the Senate, while Cruz has an eye toward 2024, when any presidential contender will likely need to stay in the good graces of Trump and his supporters. On the House side, multiple Texas Republicans have promised to object to the certification. Representatives Louie Gohmert of Tyler, Lance Gooden of Terrell, August Pfluger of San Angelo, Pete Sessions of Waco, Randy Weber of Friendswood, John Carter of Round Rock, Ron Wright of Arlington, and Ronnie Jackson, who represents the Panhandle. Wright and Carter both represent districts that National Democrats targeted in November, though both ultimately won re-election by comfortable margins. They announced their intentions Tuesday. I believe that it's critical for the future of our democracy that a full forensic hashtag audit is done before we certify the Electoral College vote, Carter tweeted. I will defend America.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Wednesday, January 6, 2021. Giles calls it a day. Retiring 142nd Midland County Court Judge Jody Giles speaks Monday after his replacement, Judge David Rogers, was sworn in the Midland County 142nd District Courtroom. Safe Driving Campaign at MHS, Lee. Permian Road Safety Coalition and Shell have partnered with App Safe to Save, to launch a three-month-long high school road safety campaign to train and reward high school student drivers in the Permian Basin for safe, undistracted driving. Those high schools participating are Midland High, Lehigh, Odessa High, Andrews High, Monahans High, Pecos High, and Kermit High. The high school road safety program is called #ArriveAlivePB, and its goal is to increase education and awareness around the dangers of distracted driving throughout the Permian Basin. The program will also award good driving behaviors through the use of the app Safe to Save. Points will be earned by safe drivers, and contests will be held between traditional sports rivaling high schools to determine which school has the safest drivers. More than $25,000 in awards will be distributed to students. The campaign will run March. Raising awareness of the risks on our roadways and working to change driver behaviors is what the PRSC is focused on every day. We are very pleased to be expanding our program this year to reach the most important drivers, the true treasure of our community, our kids, said Scott Scheffler, Executive Director of the Permian Road Safety Coalition. Everyone behind the wheel plays a role in helping make the roadways of the Permian Basin safer. That includes teen drivers, too. We want everyone to #ArriveAlivePB. Keep Midland Beautiful call for artists. The Keep Midland Beautiful Beautification Committee is putting out a call for entries to area artists. This call can be found at keepmidlandbeautiful.org, and the KMB Beautification Committee encourages area artists to apply. If a person has questions, please call KMB at 688-7745. When it's open, Midland County Tax Assessor, Collector, 2110 North A Street, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Wednesday, Friday, 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Thursday, 688-4810. Midland Central Appraisal District, 4631 Andrews Highway, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday, 699-4991. Department of Public Safety, Driver's License Office, 2800 Wright Drive, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday and Wednesday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Tuesdays, 686-1120. Watering schedule. The City of Midland has adjusted the lawn and landscaping watering schedule, which will allow residents to water 4 days a week instead of two. Even-numbered addresses can water on Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and odd-numbered addresses can water on Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. Today in history. Today is Wednesday, January 6, the sixth day of 2021. There are 359 days left in the year. Today's highlight in history. On January 6, 2001, with Vice President Al Gore presiding in his capacity as President of the Senate, Congress formally certified George W. Bush the winner of the bitterly contested 2000 presidential election. On this date, in 1912, New Mexico became the 47th state. In 1941, President Franklin D. Roosevelt, in his State of the Union address, outlined a goal of four freedoms: freedom of speech and expression, the freedom of people to worship God in their own way, freedom from want, freedom from fear. In 1994, figure skater Nancy Kerrigan was clubbed on the leg by an assailant at Detroit's Cobo Arena. Four men, including the ex-husband of Kerrigan's rival, Tanya Harding, went to prison for their roles in the attack. Harding pleaded guilty to conspiracy to hinder prosecution, but denied any advance knowledge about the assault.
This is the opinion page. This column is entitled, 2005 Election Challenge Was Bad, 2021 Is Worse, by Ramesh Panuru, Bloomberg Opinion. In January 2005, Senator Barbara Boxer, Democrat, California, objected to counting Ohio's electoral votes for President George W. Bush. It made page A19 of the New York Times. It didn't haunt her for the rest of her career. I don't remember her involvement myself until the current Republican challenge to Joe Biden's electoral victory brought it back into the news. That challenge has drawn a ferocious reaction. The Republicans behind it are being accused of subverting our form of government and lacking patriotism. They're asking why they are getting so much more heat. Josh Hawley, the Missouri Republican, who was the first senator to say he would object to the certification of Biden's election, made a point of citing Boxer and other Democrats who acted similarly after Republicans won the presidency. A lot of Republicans say they're being treated more harshly because of media bias. That's part of the explanation. But there are other reasons the Republican campaign against 2020's electoral result is a bigger story, and a more alarming one than previous Democratic election protests. Texas Republican Ted Cruz, in his letter with 10 other Republican senators explaining why they will vote against certifying the election results, put his finger on the key difference. This time, the belief that the election was stolen is widespread. They cite a poll that found that 39% of the country and 67% of Republicans agree that, quote, the election was rigged, unquote. After the 2004 election, by contrast, two-thirds of Democrats accepted that the election was conducted fairly. The senators say there are so many allegations of fraud and irregularities in voting, and so many people are concerned about them, that the election should not be certified. The allegations are, however, nonsense. None of them have withstood the slightest scrutiny. And in court, lawyers for President Donald Trump have slunk away from their shocking claims about voter fraud. Presumably, that's why the senator's letter does not hold up any particular allegation as credible. It doesn't claim that Trump actually won the election, as he keeps insisting. It doesn't even say that there's a strong probability that an audit would show that a single state was wrongly put in Biden's column. The argument rests entirely on the facts that there are a lot of allegations and that many people think there is something to them. Those facts are accurate, but they cut against what Hawley, Cruz, and their Confederates are doing. The reason so many Americans have doubts about the election, tragically, as the Cruz letter puts it, is that Trump and his allies have been sowing these doubts. Trump has made one mild claim after another, offering no evidence of any of them, and not correcting the record when proven wrong. He recently attacked Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, by saying his brother works for China. There is a Ron Raffensperger who works for the Chinese tech firm Huawei, but he is not related to the Georgia official. They have doubts as well, because too many Republicans and conservative media outlets have echoed Trump, and too few have contradicted him. With a few exceptions, such as Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, Republican senators have generally been unwilling to say what all the evidence indicates. Biden won, there was no widespread fraud, and Trump isn't telling the truth about the election. Republicans who refuse to certify the election aren't dispelling doubts, they're reinforcing them. They're telling Republican voters that there is good reason to think Biden stole the election without offering any such reason. The commission that many of the senators say should look into election irregularities is a dodge. If Republican politicians aren't willing to call the delusion that Biden stole the election what it is, they won't be willing to say it after a commission report. There are three potential harms from refusing to certify a valid election, as Boxer did, and many Republicans are now doing. First, the effort might succeed in preventing a legitimately elected president from taking office, a catastrophic possibility. but thankfully one that is remote now, just as it was in 2005. Second, by legitimizing the tactic of not certifying election results that displease senators, the effort might keep a future elected president from taking office or at least cause severe political instability. Boxer was the only senator to object in 2005. For a dozen or more senators to follow her example now and to cite her approvingly, as Hawley has, would raise this risk considerably. Third, the effort could spread the poisonous and false idea that votes are not counted fairly in U.S. elections. That danger increases the more officials till the ground for the idea, as Trump and many other Republicans have done. What Boxer did in 2005 was irresponsible and should have been widely condemned. What Republicans are doing right now is worse. This column is called Opinion Extra. It is entitled Trump's Shameful Georgia Call by Rich Lowry, King Features Syndicate. President Donald Trump has turned a narrow electoral defeat into a bid for infamy. His goal in the post-election interlude has been more and more explicitly to overturn the results of the election. Indeed, a couple of weeks ago, he tweeted simply, #overturn. We now know, thanks to a recording of his phone conversation with Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger from over the weekend, how far he's gone to pressure state officials to join him in this reprehensible goal. His hour-long lobbying of Raffensperger to declare him the winner in the state is among the worst things an American president has ever been caught saying on the record. There is now no doubt that Trump lost Georgia. Both machine and hand recounts have confirmed a Biden victory of fewer than 12,000 votes. Trump has been agitating for a signature audit, and state officials examined a statistically significant sample of 15,000 absentee ballots in Cobb County. They found 10 mismatched signatures. But the voters in question all vouchsafed for the legitimacy of the ballots when contacted by investigators. Georgia has certified its results multiple times and appointed its electors in time to meet the safe harbor deadline under federal law when they are supposed to be considered final and conclusive by the federal government. Yet here comes Trump with an LBJ-style bout of arm twisting to get Raffensperger to declare all of that a grievous mistake. The power differential between a president of the United States and a secretary of state is vast. Trump is the most powerful man on the planet, whereas Raffensperger isn't even the most powerful man in Georgia. Trump put Raffensperger in the inherently awkward position of having to tell him no over and over, snowing him with a variety of numbers for supposed illegal votes, making him parry wild accusations, mocking him, and threatening him with vague legal repercussions, and implicitly with the end of his political career. There is a reason that Raffensperger didn't take any of the reported prior 18 attempted calls from the White House. Still, to his great credit, he did indeed tell Trump no, politely and firmly. Of the two elected officials on the call, only one was calm, reasonable, and cogent, and it wasn't the president. Trump was repetitive and ill-informed. He had no idea what charges had been debunked weeks ago. He didn't, or couldn't, distinguish between true and false information. He was fuzzy on the details of his own legal case. He retailed conspiracy theories about ballots being burned and voting machines being removed that would be embarrassing if your uncle shared them on Facebook. The only thing that mattered to him was getting Raffensperger to pronounce him the winner. Legal process and facts be damned. The problem with Trump has always been his highly personal view of the presidency, wherein institutions, constitutional principles, and sheer propriety take a backseat to the felt needs of his ego. At times in his presidency, this failing has been made to serve worthy ends, e.g., stoking economic growth and confirming record numbers of conservative judges as bragging points. Since the election, though, this tendency has been particularly stark and unredeemed. His personal inability to accept the sting of defeat has led him shamefully to wage war on a legitimate election. If he were to somehow succeed in his goal of overturning the result, he would subvert American democracy and irreparably harm our governing institutions, while stoking a constitutional crisis of a magnitude we've only experienced rarely in our history. And for what? To avoid admitting that he lost? Trump has gotten nowhere except in convincing some Republican senators and members of Congress to indulge his insistence he really won. Every time the president hoped someone with authority over the election would bend his way, whether an elected official or judge, he's found someone like Raffensperger, dutiful and conscientious enough to say no. This column is entitled Grassy Knollers to Have Their Day by George Will, Washington Post Writers Group. McConnell told his caucus that in his 36 Senate years, he has twice cast votes to take the nation to war and once to remove a president, but that the vote he will cast this Wednesday to certify Joe Biden's Electoral College victory will be the most important of his career. McConnell, Republican Kentucky, understands the recklessness of congressional Republicans who are fueling the doubts of a large majority of Republicans about the legitimacy of the 2020 election. The day before McConnell's somber statement, Missouri's freshman Republican Senator Josh Hawley announced on Wednesday, 14 days before Biden will be inaugurated, he will challenge the validity of Biden's election. Hawley's conscience regarding electoral proprieties compels him to stroke this erogenous zone of the GOP's 2024 presidential nominating electorate. Hawley's stance quickly elicited panicky emulation from Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz, another 2024 aspirant. Cruz led 10 other senators and senators-elect in a statement that presents their pandering to what terrifies them, their Trumpkin voters, as a judicious determination to assess the unprecedented allegations of voting improprieties, allegations exceeding any in our lifetimes. So allegations in sufficient quantity, although of uniformly risible quality, validate senatorial grandstanding that is designed to deepen today's widespread delusions and resentments. While Hawley et al. Were presenting their last-ditch devotion to President Donald Trump as devotion to electoral integrity, Trump was heard on tape browbeating non-compliant Georgia election officials to, quote, find, unquote, thousands of votes for him. Awkward. Never mind. Hawley, has there ever been such a high ratio of ambition to accomplishment? And Cruz have already nimbly begun to monetize their high-mindedness through fundraising appeals. For many years, some people insisted that a vast conspiracy, not a lone gunman, masterminded the 1963 assassination of President John F. Kennedy near the grassy knoll in Dallas's Dealey Plaza. To these people, the complete absence of evidence proved the conspiracy's sophistication. They were demented. Today's senatorial grassy knollers, Hawley, with Cruz and others panting to catch up, are worse. They are cynical. They know that every one of the almost 60 Trump challenges to the election have been rebuffed in state and federal courts, including the Supreme Court, involving more than 90 judges nominated by presidents of both parties. But for scores of millions of mesmerized Trump Republicans who think the absence of evidence is the most sinister evidence, this proves that the courts, too, are tentacles of the deep state. Hawley and Cruz, both of whom clerked for chief justices on the Supreme Court, hope to be wafted into the White House by gusts of such paranoia. As does Vice President Mike Pence, who says about Hawley et al., "Me too." To fathom Pence's canine devotion to Trump, watch a video from June 7, 2018. Seated next to Trump in a meeting, Pence saw Trump take his water bottle off the table and place it on the floor. So Pence did likewise. Google the 22-second video. It is a sufficient Pence biography. Republican Senator Ben Sasse, Nebraska, obliquely but scaldingly said of Hawley, "Adults don't point a loaded gun at the heart of legitimate self-government. America's three-party system, Democrats, Hawley-Cruz Republicans, and McConnell-Sasse Republicans, will continue to take shape on Wednesday. Watch how many of these Republican senators who might be seeking re-election in 2022 have the spine to side with the adults against Hawley-Cruz et al. And the grassy knollers among their constituents, John Boozman, Richard Boer, Mike Crapo, Charles Grassley, John Hoeven, Mike Lee, Kelly Loeffler, if she prevails on Tuesday in the special election, Jerry Moran, Lisa Murkowski, Rand Paul, Rob Portman, Marco Rubio, Tim Scott, Richard Shelby, John Thune, Todd Young. By aligning with Cruz, three, Ron Johnson, John Neely, Kennedy, and James Lankford, have reserved their seats at the children's table. Hawley, Cruz, and company have perhaps rescued Biden from becoming the first president in 32 years to begin his presidency without his party controlling both houses of Congress. On Tuesday, Georgians will decide control of the Senate. While they have been watching Republican attempts to delegitimize Biden's election, two recounts have confirmed that Georgians favor Biden, Republicans were telling them, A, elections in the world's oldest constitutional democracy, and especially in Georgia, are rigged, but B, the nation's fate depends on their turning out for Tuesday's presumptively sham runoff election, lest C, Democrats take control of the Senate and behave badly. Be that as it may, on Wednesday, the members of the Hawley-Cruz cohort will violate the oath of office in which they swore to defend the Constitution from enemies foreign and domestic. They are its most dangerous domestic enemies. This is the obituary column, Wednesday, January 6th, 2021. Alice Martinez Robles. Alice rejoins her loved ones, Sunday T. Martinez, father, Hazel Pearl Gallegos Martinez, mother, Inez Robles, husband, Jimmy Murillo, brother, Michael William Murillo, brother, and Izzy Anaya, brother-in-law. Alice's children, April Pando Robles, Chuck Robles, Jamie Robles, four grandsons, two granddaughters. They were the pride and joy of Alice's life. She is also survived by Patsy Anaya, Florence Barella, Herman Murillo, and many nieces, nephews, and cousins in Clovis, New Mexico, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Midland, Texas, and Austin, Texas. No services will be set for Alice due to COVID. Family is just asking for plenty of prayers at this time of grievances. Belva Jean Bobby Eoff Dumas. Belva Jean Bobby Eoff Dumas, 88, of Midland, Texas, went to be with her Lord on December 20th in Midland, Texas. Bobby was born in Winters, Texas, on January 15th, 1932. Survivors include her husband, Fred Dumas, three children, Karen and Brad Winchester of Grape Creek, Texas, James and Laura Dumas of Midland, Texas, and Donna and Bob Fox of Granbury, Texas. A sister, Verda Chisholm of Denton, Texas, 6 grandchildren, and 2 great-grandchildren. Graveside services will be Friday, January 8th at 1 p.m. at Rest Haven Memorial Park. The family requests that memorials be sent to the American Cancer Society or Meals on Wheels. Elizabeth Liz Ann Drake Moore. Elizabeth Liz Ann Drake Moore of Ruidoso, New Mexico, passed away peacefully on December 20th. Born on September 12, 1938, in Hobbs, New Mexico, she was the only child of James and Ruth Drake. Liz is survived by her son, James Moore of Midland, and his wife, Karen, her daughters, Anne Moore Jensen of Tustin, California, and her husband, Lance, and her daughter, Marilyn Moore Jackson of Austin, Texas, and her husband, Dauphin. She is also survived by 4 grandchildren. She is also survived by her ex-husband, Tom Moore of Midland, Texas. Although no longer married, they shared a love for their children and grandchildren. She will be missed and loved forever. Heather Marie Cerruta. Heather Marie Cerruta, 40, of Midland, passed from this life into the arms of her Lord and Savior on Saturday, January 2nd. Services will be 10 a.m. Wednesday, January 6th at St. Stephen's Catholic Church. Interment will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Heather was born on November 25th, 1980, in Kermit, Texas. She is preceded in death by her niece, Jaquela Salazar, and is survived by her spouse, Joshua Cerruta, son Alexander Cerruta and wife Ilani Cerruta, son Gabriel Cerruta, son Jeremiah Cerruta, grandson Eli Cerruta, parents Jerry and Velma Salazar, sisters Michelle Brown Ricky, Cindy Belcher Wayne, and Lori Ramos Adrian, and numerous nieces and nephews. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Javier R. Villaseñor. Javier R. Villaseñor, 71, passed away on January 2nd in Midland, Texas. Memorial services will be held at 4 p.m. Saturday, January 9th at Willowbrook Funeral Home Chapel, with Pastor Martin Ortega officiating. Javier Villaseñor was born in La Pryor, Texas, to Jose Manuel Villaseñor and Ofelia Rodriguez Villaseñor on October 13, 1949. He is preceded in death by his mother and father, Ofelia and Jose Villaseñor, brother Efran Villaseñor, sister Graciela Ramos, and sister Enedina Martinez. Javier is survived by his children, Ofelia Villaseñor Martinez, Xavier Villaseñor, Maria Gina Ibarra, and Mr. Antonio and Sofia Villaseñor, 20 grandkids and 10 great-grandchildren, 3 sisters, Maria Leal, Imelda Costilla, and Nancy Vina, and many nieces and nephews. Funeral services entrusted to Willowbrook Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Midland. To place online condolences, please visit www.willowbrk.com. Joanne Rouse. Joanne Rouse, 86, of Weatherford, passed away Saturday, January 2nd. She was born August 12, 1934, in Mount Vernon, Texas, to Bob and Lizzie Martin Hightower. In addition to her parents, she was preceded in death by her son, Rusty Rouse, former husband Bill Rouse, brother Burian Hightower, and sisters Sue Kofel and Dorothy Jean Tittle. Anne leaves behind her loving nieces and nephews, Karen Baker, Lloyd Kofel, Jackie Holden, Bob Hightower, Nan Shockley, Jan Campbell, and Leecho Tittle, as well as a host of great-nieces and nephews and great-great-nieces and nephews. A memorial service will be held at a later date. Lawrence Leo Barber, Jr. Lawrence Leo Barber, Jr., age 82, of Odessa, passed away December 13th in Odessa. Funeral services will be at 10 a.m. Friday, January 8th, at Cumberland Presbyterian Church, 1415 Grandview Avenue in Odessa, with Jimmy Braswell officiating. Interment to follow at 2 p.m. Friday, January 8th, at Monahans Municipal Cemetery, 400 South Helen, Monahans, Texas. Lawrence was born June 26, 1938, to Lawrence Leo Barber and Daisy Helen Barber Wood in Seagraves, Texas. Lawrence L. Barber, Jr. is preceded in death by Helen Barber, wife, Christopher Howell, grandson, Lawrence Leo Barber, father, Daisy Helen Barber Wood, mother, Paul Barber, brother, and J.J. Ace and Joker, his West Highland White Terriers. He is survived in death by Deborah Barber Howell, daughter, Larry Wayne Barber, son, Lisa Barber and Frank Kuntz, daughter and son-in-law, Jerry Agnew, two grandsons, one granddaughter, brother Carol Robert and Carol Ann Barber, Mike Barber, nephew, and Jackson, his West Highland White Terrier. Memorials may be given to Breast Cancer Research and Odessa Meals on Wheels. Arrangements are entrusted to Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home. To send family condolences, please sign his guest book at www.sunsetodessa.com. Lisa Jester Meadows DeLeo, August 26, 1936 to December 29, 2020. Born in San Angelo, Lisa Jester Meadows was the first child of Elise Jester Meadows and Claude William Meadows, Jr. In addition to her children, Elise Jester Judd of Carrollton, David S. F. Judd of Lake Mary, Florida, and Claude Meadows Judd, Amy, also of Carrollton, she is survived by her grandchildren Abby E. Judd and Sarah L. Judd. She is also survived by her sister Susan M. Pfluger, Robert of San Angelo, a niece Claire C. Field, Steve of Spicewood, Texas, and nephew James T. Cowden Patrick of Austin, Texas. Memorials may be made to Alzheimer's Research or Alzheimer Foundation, Al-Anon, or Overeaters Anonymous, Seventh Tradition Contribution, or church and charities of your choice. Services will be held at a later date at St. Mark Presbyterian Church in San Angelo and a graveside memorial service. Ramon Lopez. Ramon Lopez was called home to be with the Lord on December 23, 2020. He was a young 70 years of age. He was born on July 16, 1950, in Stanton, Texas, and raised in Midland, where he lived most of his life. He is survived by his brothers Jimmy Lopez and Felix Hosso, and his sisters Domingo Benitez and Diana Lopez. His nieces Janie Herbeck and Martha Hosso, who were both raised with Ramon in Midland. He is also survived by a great number of nieces, nephews, and cousins. He was preceded in death by his mother, Alejandra Lopez, and sister Maria Angelita Castro, sister Blandina Hosso, brother Cecilio Castro, brother Oscar Lopez. A viewing for Ramon Lopez will be held on Friday, January 8th, at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Chapel from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. Rosary will be held at 7 p.m. on the same day, January 8th. Ramon expressed wishes to be cremated and buried with his mother, Alejandra Lopez, at Fairview Cemetery, and date of burial services will be announced at a later time. The Lopez family would like to express with deep gratitude for the love, prayers, and thoughts. Arrangements were made with Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin at nts-online.net. Or you can visit our website at www.LlewellynGarciaPipkinFH.com. Death Notices. Gregorio Segovia Ramirez. Gregorio Segovia Ramirez, 66, passed away December 31st. Funeral service will be held in Cedral San Luis Potosi, Mexico. Survivors include his daughter, Perla Segovia Coronada. Arrangements are entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Jack Rosvang Nielsen. Jack Rosvang Nielsen, age 59, from Midland, passed away December 31st. A memorial service will be held at a later date. Arrangements were made with Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. He is survived by his wife Diana, two daughters, Jackie Nielsen and Jessica Jackson, son Jack Anthony Nielsen, sister Anne Lee Grimson, and two grandchildren. Joe A. Longoria. Joe A. Longoria, 47, of Odessa, passed away on December 25th at Medical Center Hospital in Odessa. Joe was born on June 30th, 1973, to Carolina Longoria in Midland, Texas. He is survived by two sons, Joseph Longoria and Jonathan Longoria, his mother Carolina Longoria of Odessa, and five siblings. A celebration of life will be held on Wednesday, January 6th, 2 p.m. at American Heritage Funeral Home. Oscar Amaya Sanchez. Oscar Amaya Sanchez, 55, passed away January 1st. Funeral services will be held in Chihuahua, Mexico. Survivors include his wife, Angelica Tarango, daughter Sara Maria Sanchez, son Oscar David Sanchez, four sisters and two brothers. Arrangements are entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Sean Baker. Sean Baker, 49, of Midland, passed away December 29th. Graveside service will be held at 1 p.m. Saturday, January 16th at Eastland City Cemetery, 400 South Halbrian Street, Eastland. Private family interment will be held at a later date. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklin Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. William Bill Lee Huff. William Bill Lee Huff of 67 of Midland entered heaven on Saturday, December 19th. Celebration of life will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, January 9th at True Light Christian Fellowship in Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklin Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.